Hey folks, just a quick reminder that this episode is not meant to be used for medical advice, just good old-fashioned education. All patient information has been modified to protect their identity, and the views expressed in our podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinion of our employers.
Welcome back, Clinical Problem Solvers. My name is Dan Minter, and I wanted to thank you again for joining today for another episode of The Consult Question, a series aimed at highlighting the clinical reasoning performed by subspecialists. I'm here with my co-hosts for this series, Doug Pett and Lindsay Shipley. How are you guys doing?
Woohoo! So glad to be back. How are you all?
Doing well. Great to see you, Lindsay and Dan, over Zoom still. One day we'll all be together.
One day. I think I need to move to UCSF, though.
Hey, you're welcome anytime, you know. Any day of the
week. It's great to see you both. It's super excited to be back. I'm so excited for today's case. Lindsay and I were just talking about how we're, you know, plunging into residency interview season, which has been super fun to talk to different applicants about a lot of people with interest in clinical reasoning and different subspecialties. It's just been really inspiring.
Well, on my end, I've been, you know, deep in the diabetic foot world at the VA with the infectious diseases consults. And I had like the heavens opening moment the other day where I just saw the beauty of this clinical syndrome. It's not about the foot. The foot is a canvas for bacteriology and antimicrobial choices. So I'm just, you know, living the dream as a first year ID fellow, but so excited to see everybody virtually at this Zoom.
Dan, it's good to see that you've gone full ID nerd in your first year.
My co-fellow told me I have Stockholm syndrome with the feet as my captor, but it's been good so far.
On the consult question, an unknown case will be presented to a subspecialist discussant in the form of a consult. The discussant will be entirely blinded to the case and will be reasoning through the case extemporaneously.
In future episodes, we're hoping to feature more great cases that can highlight the amazing depth and breadth of knowledge of our subspecialty consultants so that we can learn from these experts.
If you have a case you think might be a good fit for our new series, The Consult Question, please send us an email at theclinicalproblemsolvers@gmail.com. While we can't guarantee that every case will make it through our review process, our goal is to highlight listeners from all corners of the globe and get your cases on air.
Just a quick reminder that this podcast is not meant to be used for medical advice, just good old-fashioned education. All patient information has been modified to protect their identity, and the views expressed in our podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of our employers.
On today's episode, we have the great honor of welcoming two fantastic clinicians. Dr. Michael Tomashaw is a rheumatology fellow here at UCSF. His interests include medical subspecialty education for GME and UME learners, connective tissue disease-associated interstitial lung disease, scleroderma, and systemic lupus erythematosus. I've had the great fortune of knowing Mike since I was an intern and have learned a ton from him as he's become a rock star fellow here at UCSF. So we're so incredibly happy to have him on the show where he'll be presenting today's case. How's it going, Mike?
It's going great, Dan. Thank you, Lindsay and Doug, for inviting me to be on the show today. Longtime listener, first time discussant, so I'm excited to be here.
Woohoo! Welcome.
Awesome. Welcome, Mike. Thanks for being here. And I have the great pleasure of introducing Dr. Anisha Dua. Dr. Dua is an associate professor of medicine in the Division of Rheumatology, Rheumatology Fellowship Program Director, and the Director of Northwestern Vasculitis Center at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine. Dr. Dua's interests are rheumatology education and vasculitis. She is currently the chair of the ACR in Training Exam Committee, and she leads a multidisciplinary team in the clinical management of vasculitis patients. She recently assisted in the development of the ACR guideline for the treatment and management of vasculitis, is on the board of directors for the Vasculitis Foundation, and a member of the Scientific Advisory Council for the Rheumatology Research Foundation. She has served in leadership capacities both locally and nationally throughout the ACR, the Vasculitis Foundation, and the ACGME in the areas of education as well as vasculitis. You can also follow her on Twitter at Anisha_Dua. Thank you for being here, Anisha.
Thank you guys so much for having me. That was quite the bio. I appreciate that welcome, and I'm excited to be here talking with you guys today about the case. But thanks again for having me.
We're super excited that you're here, and I think we can jump right in. We've got a great case today. Anisha will be blinded to today's case, and we're really excited to hear from her. Take it away, Mike.
Okay, Dr. Dua. So our first question for you is, in general, what is your approach to fever of unknown origin as a rheumatologist?
So, you know, we do get consults for FUs a lot, and I'm sure so do you as an ID fellow, right? So I think one of the first things that you think about with fevers is when we're getting on board, usually the person's been having fevers for an extended period of time. You think about if the patterns, right? Are they intermittent? Are they cyclic? Are they persistent? And try to sort through the history for what's been tried before for management. But I usually do the typical split. So you think about rheumatologic causes, infectious causes, malignancies. Those are probably, or, you know, toxin exposures, things like that. Those are some of the big things you think about when you're approaching someone who has persistent fevers. From the rheumatologic perspective, a lot of our diseases can be associated with low-grade fevers. Usually when you're thinking of really high fevers, you're wondering a little bit more about infection. But again, that's a little bit, there's not really a set cutoff number, you know, that you can say above this, I really think infectious, or below this, I think rheumatologic. But these are some of the most interesting consult questions in the hospital. And I think we do work a lot, like with our ID colleagues, HemOnc, to review, you know, their blood counts, their infectious work up to date, their imaging studies, and of course their clinical history to get an idea of whether it is consistent with any of our diseases like Still's disease, vasculitides, lupus. All of those are ones very quickly off the top of my head that would be in mind when you're thinking about sort of persistent fevers.
Thank you so much for that great differential and approach. You know, maybe I'll just jump right in to start the case. So this is a case of a 70-year-old woman with no significant prior medical history who presents to the emergency department with 2 weeks of fevers and arthralgias. She reports feeling overall well until 2 weeks prior to presentation, when she developed right axillary soreness and malaise. In the ensuing days, she developed recurrent daily fevers up to a Tmax of 101.6 Fahrenheit, despite taking Tylenol and ibuprofen around the clock, as well as progressive fatigue. After 2 to 3 days, she developed widespread arthralgias and myalgias, most prominently involving her hands and wrists, scapulae, buttocks, groin, knees, and toes. She denies any joint swelling or redness. She also developed new TMJ pain bilaterally with opening her jaws widely, but denied pain with chewing or jaw fatigue. 4 days into her illness, she developed new onset mild frontal headaches, most prominent at night. These resolved after 3 nights, and she denies any visual symptoms. She reports 6 pounds of weight loss in the first week of illness, despite a normal appetite. 1 week into her illness, her symptoms of fatigue and arthralgias became so severe that she needed assistance to walk to the bathroom from her bed. A trip that normally takes only a few seconds took her several minutes. And at that time, she was evaluated by her primary care physician, who ordered a broad workup, including blood cultures. A medication review revealed that she was on 3 vitamins, a multivitamin, B12, and a combo pill of calcium and vitamin D. Her initial workup revealed a complete blood count with a white blood cell count of 8 with a normal differential, a hemoglobin of 12.6, and a platelet count of 286. She had a normal creatinine of 0.77. Her LFTs revealed a normal T-bili of 0.3, an elevated alkaline phosphatase of 234, an elevated AST of 77, an elevated ALT of 89, and a normal albumin of 4.2. Her UA was within normal limits. Her ESR was elevated at 45. Her CRP was elevated at 50. She was also tested for COVID-19, and her PCR of SARS-CoV-2 returned negative, and blood cultures were preliminarily negative. She also was tested for an ANA, which returned negative, and her rheumatoid factor was mildly elevated at 14.6. Hepatitis serologies were all negative for hepatitis A, B, and C. And she also was tested for a QuantiFERON gold, which was indeterminate. Additionally, her primary care physician sent off a parvovirus IgG, which was positive, but the IgM was negative, and her CK was within normal limits. So, Dr. Dua, given the history and these initial testing results, what is your differential diagnosis for this case? And additionally, what other studies would you order at this time? And if indicated, what treatment would you start?
Great. So that's, you know, let's just walk back through a little bit of that information, because that's definitely a lot of things that you're trying to put together. So you definitely have this elderly patient, 70-year-old, and then the 2-week history of the fevers and arthralgias. The other sort of clinical things that that popped out to me in her history are the axillary soreness, the fevers, fatigue, weight loss. And then, of course, over a couple of days, it sounds like she had some other arthralgias. It didn't really sound necessarily inflammatory, at least from the description or the exam that you talked about. No swelling, no redness. The TMJ pain definitely jumps out to me. Of course, I'm a little bit, Lindsay had mentioned, I'm a vasculitis expert, so I do have a little bit of grounding thinking about TMJ soreness, and I think about things like GCA, so that always jumps out to me. But of course, you don't want to hone in on a diagnosis, so we got to think about the broader differential. Headaches, no visual symptoms, and then weight loss. So those are all, you know, concerning for rheumatologic processes. And then with the labs, you know, as I mentioned before, when you're looking at the differential, you're thinking about rheumatologic causes. You're also thinking about infectious problems or hematologic malignancies, things like that. She doesn't have a leukocytosis, and it doesn't look like she had any real chronic medical problems, which is pretty impressive for a 70-year-old. So just on a couple of vitamin supplements, no anemia, and then no thrombocytosis. So those are a couple of things that I look at. She does have a little bit of a transaminitis, like you mentioned, and then elevated inflammatory markers. You know, I think with an elderly patient with some frontal headaches and jaw soreness, elevated inflammatory markers, like I said, one thing I definitely do think about would be potentially polymyalgia rheumatica or GCA, you know, something in that sort of spectrum. And so I would be thinking about that and start doing a little bit more workup for that. Her ANA was negative. It's sort of a late age to have something like a new onset lupus. Although you can have, of course, elderly patients presenting with lupus, but the ANA negativity kind of really points away from that. And her clinical story is not completely consistent as well. You mentioned sort of the progressive joint pains, which, you know, do sound in the distribution a little bit like a polymyalgia picture, axillary, that kind of is, you know, near your shoulders. You're thinking about neck and shoulder girdle involvement, hip and sort of groin area. But you also mentioned her hands and knees, which you can get peripheral involvement as well with actually PMR, but you still want to think about different inflammatory arthritides. Her RF was negative. You know, I might, depending on what her exam looked like, I might get some further imaging of some of the joints or a musculoskeletal ultrasound if there was something that was sticking out to me on exam, if she had limited range of motion in her joints. But again, the weight loss, the persistent fevers, her age, the sort of pain distribution, and then this jaw soreness with headache are really kind of leading me in my head towards at least concern or moving forward with a workup for like a large vessel vasculitis or polymyalgia rheumatica. So I guess the second part of that, of course, differential-wise, like I said, there are still other things on the differential. So I'm assuming I have other colleagues that are also taking a look at her case. I agree definitely with looking for infectious causes, right? So viral infections, hepatitis, you guys check those serologies, especially with that mild transaminitis. And then TB, a lot of different, you know, parvo, CMV, a lot of those can cause sort of these chronic arthralgias and fevers. So, you know, pursuing that infectious workup, as it seems like was already happening, that's still on the differential because it could still be definitely an issue. I don't really know her like history or any history of like malignancies or anything that could be recurring. So of course you would still be looking for that. Her smear didn't look super worrisome, but that axillary pain, I would definitely be feeling for lymph nodes, looking to see if there's something that goes along with more of a lymphoma or something like that as well. So that's just sort of broadly thinking about some of the things that would pop up quickly on a differential. In terms of studies that I would order that would be more directed to rheumatology, I would do a pretty good physical exam. You already got the inflammatory markers. And, you know, with something like polymyalgia, there's not like a lot of our diseases, actually, there's not one blood test. I mean, I know we order a lot of serologies, but there's not usually one blood test that tells us 100% this is what's going on. So it's a combination, as always, of lab tests, radiology, clinical presentation exam, and looking at some of the serologies and stuff like that. So I would probably get a little bit more information about her headaches. I know they were frontal headaches, and, you know, just make sure that she doesn't have any temporal artery tenderness or anything like that. I may still pursue a temporal artery ultrasound if there was any concerns for like jaw claudication. Again, you said it was more like TMJ, but it can be really hard for patients to differentiate between those two things. And it's kind of strange to just get like new onset TMJ along with these other symptoms, you know? So I would question that it's just TMJ arthritis. And I would, I would probably consider, like I said, a temporal artery ultrasound. And then I would, honestly, based on what was going on here with the negative infectious work up to date, I would consider challenging her with like a low, moderate dose of prednisone with for PMR. But I would first like to get a little bit more information, including having the ophthalmologist just look at her eyes to make sure that there's not any concerns for like an anterior ischemic optic neuropathy or something like that, just because you don't want to miss giant cell arteritis. And that's something that can be on the spectrum with polymyalgia-like symptoms. And that would require a much higher dose of prednisone. But I have, like I said, a little bit of concern here for both PMR and for GCA. That's kind of my first thoughts. I know she doesn't comment on she doesn't have visual symptoms, but the headaches are a little bit concerning, the elevated inflammatory markers and this weight loss constitutional symptoms. Like I said, I would be concerned for GCA and PMR.
Amazing. Thank you for that tour de force review of this data so far. So I have a couple of just clarifying questions from some of the pearls that you brought up, going through your differential and some of the additional questions and studies you would think about ordering. So first, I just wanted to bring your attention to her elevated liver enzymes. So that elevated ALK-FOS, mildly elevated AST of 77, mildly elevated ALT of 89. Does that change how you're thinking about your differential at all? And maybe you could speak to those findings in the setting of the specifically the rheumatic diseases that you mentioned, PMR and GCA.
Yeah, I mean, you can definitely get an elevated ALK-FOS with GCA. I don't classically think of a transaminitis with GCA and PMR, but I've seen some low-grade elevations. And like I said, the ALK-FOS can definitely be elevated. I'm not totally certain how to explain that, but when I see elevated liver enzymes, I do think about sometimes like Still's disease, and you can get high ferritin, you can get a transaminitis with that. I know she has fevers, she doesn't really have any of the other major classic features that would go along with, in my mind, for like an adult onset Still's, she doesn't fit some of the other criteria, but you can see an elevated liver enzymes with that. You know, when you think about other vasculitides, you think about cryoglobulinemia, that can be associated with hepatitis. Again, your hepatitis serologies were negative, so thinking less about something along those lines. I do, think about inflammatory myositis, because when you have elevations in your CK, you can definitely get elevations in your AST and ALT, and she could, potentially have an adult onset inflammatory myositis, like dermatomyositis, polymyositis. Clearly, she didn't have a rash, and it looks like, I believe you had mentioned that her CKs were normal. And I don't know what her strength exam was like. I mean, but when you think about someone needing a lot of assistance to get to the bathroom, weight loss, sort of this diffuse pain and proximal pain in like the hips, like hip region, shoulder area, that's definitely something that would be on your radar as a possibility. I probably wouldn't jump to like looking for, an MRI of her femurs and to see if she needs, a muscle biopsy or something along those lines, especially with that normal CK. It just really takes that off the table a lot.
Great. And then, her rheumatoid factor was mildly elevated. It wasn't strikingly high, does that change how you think about the differential at all? Or do you sort of say, mildly elevated, I'm not too worried about it. She's clearly inflamed.
Yeah. So that's a good point. When you can get so many reasons for false positive or just, positive rheumatoid factors. And it does happen more in the elderly population. So you just sort of can get these low grade ANAs and low grade rheumatoid factor positivities. So I don't hang my hat too heavily anything much on just a low grade positive, unless it fits with the clinical story. Because rheumatoid factor, right, is just like immunoglobulins essentially attaching to each other. So it's not specific for rheumatoid arthritis. It can be elevated in cryo, can be elevated in Sjogren's, it can be elevated in other rheumatic diseases outside of RA, but also, of course, other infectious and also just regularly. So I wouldn't do too much with that positive rheumatoid factor. With the joint pains you were describing, they really do sound more like arthralgias. You can get, adult onset RA, more like rapid onset. When we think about RA generally, we think of it more of as an insidious onset, and one of the criteria pieces has to do with the length of how long you have joint symptoms, morning stiffness lasting this long. Classically, it gets better with activity. And it didn't really sound consistent with her clinical story. Of course, in some cases, you know, the diseases don't follow the textbook and you can get sort of a more severe diffuse presentation. But with the way that things progressed, I would think more of like a viral arthralgias or something along those lines, as opposed to a rheumatoid arthritis. If I was really concerned, I would get a CCP. But again, the picture's not really making me super concerned with that low positive RF in terms of pursuing rheumatoid arthritis as a diagnosis.
Amazing. Thank you for that. Maybe the last question before we turn to the next aliquot. You mentioned that sometimes it can be really difficult to tease out like jaw claudication versus TMJ. And I was just wondering if you have any other, you know, how do you ask patients about jaw pain when you're worried about GCA?
Yeah, no, it's tough because even when you're asking about headaches or a lot of these symptoms, you really have to kind of guide people, but you don't want to put words in their mouth. And so, you know, one of the clues here is she doesn't have a history of TMJ arthritis, right? And of course, some people develop it at some time, but to develop new TMJ pain without a history of like teeth grinding or other issues sort of coming on a little bit more insidiously, unless someone had some trauma to their TMJ joint, you would expect like a regular TMJ arthritis to come on a little bit insidiously, as opposed to right now when she's having all of these other symptoms. So when I'd ask about it, I do ask like what you mentioned, you know, do you have sort of soreness in your jaw that's new? Does it feel like when you're trying to eat or chew on anything, or if you were chewing on gum for a long time, does that bother you? And, you know, you think about sort of the blood supply to the masseter muscles and that, you know, when that's compromised, then you start getting more ischemia, you get more soreness. And that's what usually causes some of that classic TMJ jaw claudication symptoms, right? But not everyone experiences that the same way. So they might just feel it when they're opening their mouth, and that's enough activity for them to have that lack of blood flow and feel some of those symptoms. Usually you'd expect the more you're using those muscles, the more severe you would feel that sort of soreness or fatigue. But there's not one great way to word it. And I'm assuming just based on the way you told the story that you asked it exactly that way by saying, you know, do you get soreness in your jaw when you're chewing on something? More when you're repeatedly chewing, right? So something like gum, meat, something where you got to like chew a lot. But just saying that she doesn't have it with chewing and she does have this new onset pain with opening her jaws wide, I still have concern there for jaw claudication. And then the last thing I just wanted to mention that you made me think of with the rheumatoid arthritis question, I know it's not really on the RF piece of things, but when you have polymyalgia, you actually can get in a subset of cases like a peripheral inflammatory arthritis that looks exactly like rheumatoid arthritis. She doesn't have that clinical picture from what you described, but that is something that you want to think about even in your PMR patients when they've got some of that peripheral joint pain and inflammation. It doesn't necessarily mean that they've got a new diagnosis also of rheumatoid arthritis. It could just be that they have some inflammatory arthritis associated with their polymyalgia. And actually, if you ultrasound the shoulders, you see like inflammation and bursitis and stuff like that. So just a thing to keep in mind.
Terrific. Okay. So moving on to the next aliquot. With these results so far, she was started on a solid dose of prednisone, 40 milligrams a day by her primary care physician. So this is a week in, just to give you a time course, this is a week into her symptom onset. And the primary care physician started her at 40 out of concern for PMR. Her last fever was the day before starting prednisone, and it was 101.2 Fahrenheit. So she says that the prednisone improved her symptoms substantially, and that improvement lasted about 6 hours. And then the effect wore off sort of with the return of diffuse arthralgias in a similar distribution that I previously described, as well as profound fatigue into the evening hours. So the next day, her primary care physician increased the dose to 60 milligrams. And she says she felt about 70% better overall on this higher dose of prednisone. But still didn't feel back to normal. She was still needing to nap in the afternoon. She had ongoing arthralgias at night, albeit they weren't as severe as before, but they were still present. And after 4 days at this dose, she was advised to take the dose down to 30 milligrams a day, given there was some confusion as to the underlying diagnosis, and her primary care physician had difficulty explaining her persistent symptoms at this dose of 60 milligrams a day. So it was at this time that she presented to the emergency department for additional evaluation. So in addition to the already presented history, she again denied any vision changes throughout the 2 weeks of her illness. She didn't have any sore throat, no oral ulcers, no rashes, no joint swelling, no chest pain or shortness of breath. no cough or urinary symptoms. Besides those couple of days of frontal headaches that I previously described, she denied any other headaches and no tenderness over her temporal area of her scalp. She reported ongoing fatigue and pain, most prominently in her wrists, hands, and scapula, as well as her hip flexors, particularly with movement. I remember her specifically telling me that she was fine as long as she wasn't trying to move, and then the pain would immediately come on. In terms of a little bit about her social history, she lives in the Bay Area. She denied any recent travel or farm animal exposure, no recent tick bites. She had former regular alcohol intake, about 1 to 2 drinks a day, until she stopped about 2 months ago due to the development of GERD. No illicit drug history, and she had a remote tobacco history in her 20s. She had a dog and a cat, but no cats. And family history-wise, she has a son who has psoriasis and a cousin with lupus and type 1 diabetes. So on exam at this time, her vital signs were within normal limits. And I'll just remind you that she did take a dose of 30 milligrams of prednisone the morning of her presentation to the emergency department. On exam, she was well appearing. There was no tenderness to palpation over her scalp, no oral ulcers, no conjunctival injection or lymphadenopathy of the head and neck. She had normal heart and lung sounds. Her abdomen was soft and non-tender. She had no deformity or synovitis. Her range of motion of both her small and large joints were full. Interestingly, there was noted to be splinter hemorrhages on her bilateral thumbnails. There were no petechiae, Osler nodes, or Janeway lesions, and her neuro exam was unremarkable. She had normal strength. In light of her fevers, fatigue, arthralgias, her incomplete response to prednisone, her elevated LFTs of unclear etiology, and the finding of splinter hemorrhages on exam, she was admitted for evaluation for infective endocarditis and was started on vancomycin and ceftriaxone, and prednisone was discontinued. Her admission workup, she had a complete blood count, which revealed an elevated white blood cell count at this time of 14.4 with a left shift that was neutrophilic. Her hemoglobin and platelets were within normal. Her creatinine was within normal limits. Her alkaline phosphatase was, again, elevated at 157, albeit down from previous. Her AST was now normal at 23, and her ALT was only mildly elevated at 54, and her T-bili was still within normal limits. Her CRP at this time was 21, and her ESR was 57. Her HIV test was negative. Her TSH was checked, and that was normal. And then she got a number of imaging studies. She got a CT of her chest, abdomen, and pelvis with contrast, which did not reveal any acute pathology within the chest, abdomen, or pelvis. She also had an echocardiogram, a transthoracic echocardiogram, that showed a normal ejection fraction without any vegetations and was noted to be a technically adequate study. She also got a right upper quadrant ultrasound, given her elevated LFTs, which showed mild biliary duct dilatation. After several days in the hospital, she was eventually discharged home after monitoring for 48 hours off antibiotics, and the prednisone was not restarted at that time. Following discharge, additional workup for Lyme, toxoplasmosis, Brucella, Bartonella, Coxiella, CMV, RPR, and Quantiferon Gold all returned negative. So, Dr. Dua, at this juncture, do you feel comfortable calling this PMR and resuming prednisone? What can make a presentation of PMR atypical? And how often do you encounter that in practice?
Okay, yeah. So this is, you know, a lot. And so she came in, you know, she went to the ER, which is great. But of course, it's always complicated by these variable responses and sort of lukewarm responses to prednisone and then the changes with doses. It does make it sort of hard to look back and get a clear clinical picture, of course, you know. I think when we think about classic polymyalgia rheumatica, when we're not thinking of GCA, you really expect a almost like complete resolution of symptoms in 48 to 72 hours. And you really actually expect that with lower doses of prednisone. So, you know, 20 milligrams once a day for 3 days, I usually really see classically a almost complete improvement in symptoms in these patients with just classic PMR. So she doesn't have that clinical story, right? She was treated with more prednisone than usually is required for sort of calming down the PMR. And then even on the 60, still having all these arthralgias and pain also, you know, and we talked a little bit about the PMR with the wrist inflammation, and that can be consistent. but that's not a great response to prednisone. So it's definitely not classic polymyalgia rheumatica. She was treated for this endocarditis. Did her fevers resolve with this treatment?
So after starting prednisone, her fevers never recurred, actually.
Okay.
So that was a lot. And even in the hospital off prednisone, she had no fever.
Okay. So she definitely had some sort of partial response in some of her symptoms to the prednisone. Of course, prednisone is going to drive down fevers anyway. And then she doesn't have your classic cranial symptoms of GCA, because when you've got giant cell arteritis, you know, you definitely need the higher doses of prednisone. So 1 mg/kg/day. If you're worried about vision loss, sometimes people will do some IV prednisone beforehand. She doesn't have the cranial symptoms, but you do always want to think about sort of other large vessel involvement, which is definitely under-recognized in these patients with imaging of the large blood vessels. It looks like, you know, she has a significant family history with some autoimmunity, right? With the son with psoriasis, cousin with lupus and type 1 diabetes. Again, that doesn't give her any specific set risk for one of these diagnoses, but it just, you keep that in mind when you're thinking about someone with arthralgias that's sort of prednisone responsive and stuff like that. I'm just looking through some of the other stuff. So her TEE or TTE did not show any sort of vegetation, right? Yeah, no vegetation and normal EF. And I know she had those splinter hemorrhages, but also, you know, her fevers resolved with prednisone, you're saying, and then she came into the hospital. I mean, usually with an endocarditis, you're not going to get better with prednisone. So that's something just to keep in mind, right? Her CVC had a leukocytosis with a left shift, and I would not necessarily call that infectious because she was just started on prednisone, right? So that's going to drive up your white count and also usually create sort of that demargination where you get some neutrophilia. Still with elevated inflammatory markers. So you did get a CT chest, abdomen, pelvis with contrast. You know, again, that is something I would think about when you're looking for large vessel involvement. I usually like to get a CT angiography to look for some of the classic features of large vessel involvement or some sort of to look for inflammation essentially in large vessels. And you're always going to try to examine your patients where you're concerned for that and listen for Bruis and other, you know, features of large vessel inflammation. So would I feel comfortable calling this PMR and resuming prednisone? Honestly, it is very much atypical. You don't, you know, like I said, everyone doesn't follow the textbook, especially in a lot of rheumatic diseases. So I do see atypical cases of PMR with, you know, younger patients presenting or that than I typically expect, or, you know, not responding to my usual 20 milligrams of prednisone in that classic time. But it's rare, honestly. I usually see more classic presentations. And when I do have this sort of atypical case where you're really requiring that much prednisone, I would pause and think about what else I might be missing. So I wouldn't necessarily be comfortable completely calling this PMR. Would I resume prednisone? I think I would have to look at her course, right? So if she's out of the hospital now, still not having fevers after this treatment, I would need to see how she's doing, honestly. I would want to figure out, is she still having these joint pains? Is she still having recurrence of those low-grade fevers and those symptoms that she came in with the hip girdle, shoulder girdle, all that type of stuff? So I would not necessarily put her on prednisone on discharge because I don't really feel like the diagnosis is completely clear yet. And I would want to regroup and see how she does now that you've done this treatment and hospitalization and the rest of the workup.
That's such an incredible discussion, Anisha. I've just really enjoyed listening to you and might go back and forth talk rheumatology. It's been really fun. One quick question. So since you're thinking, you know, maybe not PMR, maybe thinking something else, what are some other things that you'd be thinking about and what kind of diagnostic workup would you think about pursuing next?
I'm still concerned about like low-grade malignancies that are being missed or not low-grade. I mean, I don't really know that there's a low-grade malignancy, but I'm just not convinced. I don't know that we've ruled everything out. And this response is just not classic. It doesn't mean that she doesn't have PMR. I mean, she could, but I would still be concerned about some sort of like large vessel involvement. Her inflammatory markers were still consistently high. Again, they don't go down right away when you treat, you know, so they're not necessarily going to normalize within those couple of days. And there can be a lag between lab work getting better and someone feeling better. I might honestly consider doing a repeat angiogram or even like a PET scan or something looking for what's going on. But it really depends on how she's doing. So if she leaves the hospital and is doing awesome, then of course, I'm not going to keep on trying to pursue other stuff. But if she leaves and she starts redeveloping some of these fevers and other symptoms, again, I would have to loop back and think, is this, you know, consistent with PMR? And I would probably not jump to a high dose of prednisone. I would use somewhere between 15 and 20 and see if she has more of a classic response. Maybe she had some low-grade infection, you know, her transaminitis improved. But again, I would want some sort of imaging, and whether it's a PET or an angiogram to look for some sort of like large vessel involvement, I'm not sure, but I would probably be thinking in that range and really base it on how she goes over the next like week or two out of the hospital. I know that's not like a very great answer. Unfortunately, a lot of, you know, rheumatology is inpatient and some of it is outpatient. So we don't always have, you know, here's what it is and here's the treatment. And you do have to just kind of watch as the disease evolves because it doesn't always come in, you know, nice and clean textbook wise. So I hesitate to put labels on things until I'm pretty certain. I'll tell them it seems inflammatory. It sounds like there's an autoimmune process or it has this sort of flavor to it. But in terms of a label, which can be frustrating for patients, but in terms of giving you a label, once you give someone a label, it's so hard to take it away. And so I just want them to understand, you know, where my uncertainty is and why I think there's something autoimmune, but why I'm not sure what it is until I've got a better, clear answer that's going to help me like guide, you know, therapy and really give the patient that comfort that they're looking for with a clear diagnosis.
The only place I'll disagree with you there is that I think that is a fantastic explanation. Yeah, I feel like I'm at a seminar on like the art of clinical diagnosis. I just wanted to kind of pull out and acknowledge like the degree of diagnostic and reasoning restraint that you're using, which is really amazing. And I think from what I've seen working with rheumatologists is something you guys have to do on a really regular basis. And also just to, you know, that I think that was demonstrated when Mike was kind of pulling out these kind of vaguely abnormal labs and asking you, you know, what do we make of this? And I think one of the real amazing things that rheumatologists, but also, you know, like ID specialists, you know, particularly do is they're able to like take these labs, put them in an amazing context and really stay true to the clinical history, which is totally what I hear you doing. And I think that's really hard, especially for people outside of the field. And it's really valuable for us to hear your perspective on that. So thank you for going through it so eloquently.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I know I have to keep on sort of going back and reading through what you presented again, but that's kind of what we do when we're on consult service. You know, you just go back and sort of re-tease through the history and figure out like what fits in and what doesn't. And like I've been mentioning this whole time, you know, people don't follow the textbook. And so it's great when they do, and then it's an easy diagnosis and you've got your diagnosis and plan, but then you wouldn't be talking about it on this format, right? So usually there's just a lot more nuance. And like I said, I think patients want an answer, consulting services, primary services want an answer. And you know, everyone does their best to try to find that. But I think one of the worst things is really to jump to a diagnosis when you really just don't know what it is. And patients understand that you're working it up, you know, and that it may take days, it may take weeks, it may take months. So yeah, I just think being careful with the label because, you know, once the patient leaves the hospital, they show up at the outpatient clinic and they've got this new diagnosis. And if you're really just not sure about that diagnosis, you end up exposing them. You not only like do you make them really worried about something they may not have, you end up exposing them to a lot of toxic medicines that have a lot of side effects. And so it really can spin out into, you know, really going too far down the wrong path. So yeah, I just think it's something that's important to step back and tread lightly unless you really have to pull the trigger on something. And if someone's, you know, really not doing well in the hospital, you know, we do have to pull the trigger on heavy duty medications without a very clear, definitive pathologic, you know, serologically supported diagnosis, but that's a different situation. So yeah, this just depends on how the person's doing.
Thank you so much, Dr. Dua, for that perspective. And it's definitely something that I've, as a fellow in rheumatology, I've grown to appreciate is that, you know, many times when we're taking care of patients in the hospital, we work with our infectious disease colleagues, our, you know, our hospital medicine colleagues to kind of rule out the life-threatening diagnoses. And then once we feel comfortable with that, even if we don't have an answer, sometimes we need that time to really allow the patient to evolve to see what happens. So thank you so much for that perspective. That's really crucial to this case. So moving on to the next aliquot, 2 weeks after discharge, she had outpatient follow-up with rheumatology. At that time, she reported that since leaving the hospital, she had daily severe fatigue, again, requiring her to nap every day in the afternoon. Normally, she's a pretty active individual and walks 3 miles a day and swims regularly. And since the onset of the illness preceding the hospital, but again, since the hospitalization, she's only been able to walk about half a mile a day. And since leaving the hospital, she's reported daily joint pain and stiffness, predominantly in her shoulders and neck. and her joint pain and stiffness at the hip flexors, knees, elbows, and wrists has largely improved, interestingly. She's denied any fever since leaving the hospital, but has reported a low-grade frontal headache intermittently, but she's denied any visual changes. So given some ongoing diagnostic uncertainty, as you brought up in the last discussion, a PET scan was ordered, and that PET scan showed hypermetabolism in the bilateral shoulder joints, the right sternoclavicular joint, the bilateral latissimus dorsi muscles, and the bilateral hip joints. So in the context of this case at this point in time, how do you interpret this PET scan result as well as her ongoing symptoms? And if you have one, what is your final diagnosis?
Okay, great. No, so I'm glad that there was sort of this clinical course that was watched and that she wasn't on prednisone, because it really does allow us to sort of watch the natural history of her disease a little bit better. And I think, you know, she's clearly debilitated, and it looks like the soreness and everything really localized more to the neck shoulder area, which is much more classic for polymyalgia. And no fevers. And you know, that's reassuring. And it sounds like she's doing a little bit better overall than she was, at least at her initial presentation. I don't know if she had some sort of concomitant viral infection before. You know, it's hard to be 100% certain, but with the PET scan, which I think definitely makes sense. Again, you're looking for malignancies or anything like that, or increased uptake in the blood vessels or any of that. And it is showing that hypermetabolism. Again, PET scans are great studies, and they're hard to sometimes get approved, but they can be really valuable in showing this hypermetabolism. Again, it can happen with a lot of different things. So it can happen with inflammation. It can happen with infections. It's not specific for vasculitis per se or any set thing, but it really just shows that glucose uptake into the cell and that increased activity. So with the distribution of where the uptake is, I would say that that is more suggestive or consistent with polymyalgia rheumatica, because that's really where you expect to see that inflammation. Like I was mentioning, the bursitis, if you do an ultrasound, a musculoskeletal ultrasound, you see increased blood flow in that area as well, and inflammation. So I think based on all of sort of her clinical course moving forward, it does sound consistent with polymyalgia rheumatica. You know, these frontal headaches, it's a little tough because we always, you know, the other name for GCA is temporal arteritis, right? And so you just think, okay, a temporal sided headache. But again, as I mentioned, how people don't follow the textbook, it's really about large vessel inflammation. And there's many other sort of larger branches of blood vessels outside of that temporal artery. The reason it's thought about as temporal arteritis is because that's the one that's most amenable to biopsy. But that's not even the one that causes the vision loss that we think of classically with GCA, right? That's more your ophthalmic artery and other arteries or retinal arteries. So any of those vessels can be affected. And so you think classically of this temporal headache, but it's not always so clear. Anyway, that's a long-winded way of saying that I think this is more consistent with polymyalgia rheumatica based on our PET scan, because it doesn't look like there was uptake in any of the other large vessels, and it was really more localized to the classic PMR distribution. So I'd probably start her on some lower dose steroids, honestly, for a longer period of time and see how she responds. So like 15 to 20 milligrams, something like that.
Perfect. So thank you so much for that discussion and putting your foot down on for a final diagnosis. So she was exactly as you described. So she was subsequently diagnosed with PMR and started on a prednisone dose of 15 milligrams daily. And at follow-up, 1 month after starting 15 milligrams daily, she reported resolution of symptoms, and at this time continues on a slow prednisone taper. So I know that you already, you know, discussed some of the diagnostic utility of advanced imaging, such as ultrasound or PET scan and the diagnosis of PMR, but maybe with the time that we have remaining, you can take, with your expert lens as a vasculitis expert, looking back through this case and, with the retrospectoscope, is there a point at which, you mentioned really early on that you might have tried to use an ultrasound to look at the temporal arteries. And I know in the rheumatology world here, we don't use ultrasound nearly enough for the diagnosis of GCA. And I was curious if you could talk a little bit about ultrasound or MRI and sort of the thinking behind some of those imaging techniques when we're worried about GCA, maybe in the context of PMR or just as an isolated syndrome.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And there's a lot of different pieces in there to explore, and I'll try not to be super verbose. But you know, all these different imaging modalities have really helped with our ability to diagnose vasculitis, GCA, and polymyalgia rheumatica dramatically. Every single one of them has pros and cons, right? Of course, these are non-invasive, so that's nice and don't require, you know, a biopsy. But the first one I'll talk about is ultrasound, right? So I had mentioned getting the temporal artery ultrasound. Now, that's not available at all centers. That is widely used in Europe for the first step in looking or evaluating somebody with suspected GCA. The ACR and Vasculitis Foundation guidelines, which we just published this year, they actually recommend going for a temporal artery biopsy first. And that's really when we're thinking about GCA. And that's really based on experience and expertise, because ultrasound is very user dependent. And so unless you really know how to use it and make that diagnosis, you can miss it and miss this disease, right, that needs to be treated. The other thing with ultrasound is that some of the really classic features of ultrasound completely resolve quickly or more quickly once you start prednisone. And that's also one of the things we worry about with PET scanning. So if you're going to put someone on prednisone, I think before she had gone to the hospital, she had been on some course of prednisone for, I can't remember exactly, but it was maybe a week or so at least, right? And so—
Yes, that's exactly right.
Okay, so once you're on prednisone for that amount of time, you really start losing the diagnostic utility of some of these tests in terms of sensitivity and specificity. So it, you know, if it's positive, great. But if it's then at least you got your diagnosis. But if it's negative, is it really because you are already partially treated or started treatment for the disease, right? The other issue with ultrasound is that when you're thinking about GCA specifically, like I mentioned, it really can affect all of the large blood vessels. So you're really worried about the aortic branches, the subclavian carotids, and also, you know, feeding your arms and legs. So you can't image the thoracic blood vessels, the thoracic aorta, with ultrasound because of the chest wall. So that's an area that gets missed. And in GCA specifically, there's higher risk of developing thoracic aortic aneurysms. And again, that's not always at diagnosis, but that can happen over the next, you know, 5 to 10 years. So it's something that you keep an eye on, and ultrasound doesn't do a good job of looking at that. MRIs or MRAs and CT angiography, those are definitely two modalities that are reasonably accessible over PET scan. I would say, you know, when we think about other large vessel vascular disease like Takayasu's, MRA is usually our first or our main diagnostic and monitoring radiology tool that we use. And that's partly because it avoids all of the radiation of CT scans. And usually when you think about Takayasu's arteritis, this is a younger population, and they're going to be exposed to repeat imaging for a long period of time. So you really don't want to use something that exposes them to that much radiation over their lifetime because of CT scans. So with GCA, with this elderly population or PMR, I often tend to use CT angiography. And then there are some, you know, classic features that you can pick up on imaging that are consistent with inflammation. It can be a little bit difficult sometimes to differentiate some of the features that are more consistent with vasculitis versus something like atherosclerosis, which is really common, right, in our elderly population. And I won't go into the nuances, but there are some ways that you can get a clue as to whether it seems more like atherosclerosis or whether it seems more like a vasculitis, depending on how the blood vessel is affected and the type of enhancement that you see on imaging and where the enhancement is. But CT angiography can be really helpful in evaluating large blood vessels. And I do that in all of my patients when I have a diagnosis of GCA at baseline. And also, if I have somebody who doesn't have those classic cranial symptoms, but I'm concerned about GCA and they don't have cranial symptoms, you still really want to think about large vessel inflammation, because you can have large vessel GCA without any sort of cranial findings. And then the last one is the PET scan. So with PET, you've got to combine it with something, right? So PET usually goes along with a CT scan because you need that anatomy. And so you can do PETs with CT scans, you can do PETs with MRI as well, but it is harder to get covered. And so there's not always as much access unless you're at, you know, some of the larger academic centers or other centers that have the availability of the machine. It's very expensive. You know, you still have to combine it with something that could increase your radiation. And one of the main issues is that it's, you know, it's really helpful in terms of showing inflammation, but it's not specific. And there's pros and cons with PET as well, but it's another one of those things that once you treat with prednisone for a period of time, a lot of the classic findings that you're looking for in that PET scan in terms of inflammation can resolve. So I think that's probably my briefest way of saying it. So I do think that advanced imaging is really useful. You know, we still lean towards doing a temporal artery biopsy, especially if we do happen to have access to an ultrasound and we still have high suspicion and the ultrasound is negative, we still will go ahead and get that temporal artery biopsy, because the tissue changes, while they can occur, they actually can persist. The abnormalities can persist for a lot longer, even while on prednisone. Ideally, we want to get biopsies in the first 2 weeks. And, you know, we can talk about some of that data, but the sooner the better. But really, you can actually, there's some studies looking even farther out, you know, up to a year, and you can still see some of those classic features that can help you get that, clinch that diagnosis and say, okay, you do have GCA and you need to be aggressively treated for it. I don't use as much imaging generally for PMR, unless I'm worried about the evolution or evolving vasculitis. So if I have a PMR patient, and you can develop, you know, GCA or large vessel inflammation at any point, and PMR is one of the biggest, you know, risk factors. So whenever you're following a PMR patient in clinic, you're always asking about GCA symptoms. And so, you know, I'm always asking about the headaches, vision loss, all that stuff. And so if I have a PMR patient who isn't doing well, or I'm really having trouble pulling down their prednisone, or their inflammatory markers are going up, all of those things might prompt me to think, hey, is there something else going on in the large blood vessels? And do I need to consider, especially if they're not complaining of cranial symptoms, but just more fatigue, malaise, and low-grade fevers, that kind of stuff. Those are things that would prompt me to look at the large blood vessels and get, like I said, my usual go-to is a CT angiography, but I think there's, you know, there's debate on what the best next imaging modality is.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Dr. Dua. This has been such a rich discussion. I just wanted to, kind of drive home the point. One of the main points from this case is that, as you mentioned, really with when you're looking at your patients who have PMR over time, and when they're not responding as you expect, that's when you start thinking about other diagnoses in the differential and going back even to that starting point of the FUO workup. Right. And when I was doing some reading and preparing this case, I did come across two prospective studies, one from 2007 and another from 2012, that were looking at PMR patients in their response to low-dose glucocorticoids. And interestingly, in both studies, about a quarter to 26 to 29% of patients did not have that brisk response to prednisone, that actually they had sort of an incomplete response that lasted 2 to 3 weeks in some cases. So, you know, it's important, I think, for the listeners to walk away from this case with the understanding that PMR is not classic all the time, like you described, and that it actually could be as high as a quarter of patients may not respond within that 24 to 72 hour period with complete resolution of symptoms, as we sort of are taught early on. And that whenever that happens, it's important to revisit the diagnoses and think about those other differential diagnoses from that FUO, as we initially discussed. Dan and Doug, you have any other additional questions?
I apologize for having the camera off this entire time. Anisha, you would have seen my jaw totally dropped to the floor. It was as if you had read the case ahead of time and were anticipating every single piece of data that Mike was going to throw at you. But that was so fantastic. I really appreciate both of you coming on to teach all of us and all the listeners of the podcast. With this particular series, I think one of the great things is that, you know, we can span education for, you know, teaching points for early career learners up to, you know, sort of seasoned subspecialists. And I feel like you've done that so beautifully during this episode. Maybe just one thing to clarify for maybe early career learners, and I think you mentioned this at the beginning, Anisha, but just what would the top list of rheumatologic diagnoses that can cause FUO, just to sort of reinforce that for our earlier career folks?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think when you're just thinking about rheumatologic causes, you know, we think about inflammatory arthritis and connective tissue diseases, vasculitides, right? And so with our inflammatory arthritides like rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, ankylosing spondylitis, you know, some of those types of things, we don't really expect high-grade fevers. You might get some low-grade fevers and malaise and stuff like that, but it's usually not really something that is going to put someone in the hospital with persistent fevers. So I tend to lean more towards our sort of connective tissue disease vasculitic realm. And so when you think about fevers, you know, I mentioned adult onset Still's disease, that's rare, but it's something you think about. Any of the vasculitides, really small, medium, or large, so, you know, PAN, ANCA vasculitis, GCA, like we talked about, can all cause sort of fevers, persistent fevers, and then you're starting to look more at the clinical clues. Lupus can be associated with fevers. Some folks with like low grade, with myositis can also have some low grade fevers as well. And then, you know, and then there's also like viral, like I mentioned, some of the other viral associated syndromes like that can, like PAN can be with viruses, hepatitis, and same with cryoglobulinemia. So there can be some overlap there. And those are things that I think about with fevers in my patients from a rheumatologic perspective. I'm sure there are many others, but those are the things that probably come to the front of my mind when I'm seeing somebody with persistent fevers. So vasculitis is definitely up there, which is nice for me because that's really sort of my wheelhouse. But I think you want to keep it broad, of course. So you do think about a lot of the other connective tissue types of diseases. So mixed connective tissue disease, lupus, like I said.
Amazing. Thank you so much. Doug, you had a reflection, it sounds like?
Yeah, well, I would just totally echo what Dan was saying. So appreciate you both being here, and Mike for bringing us this case, and Anisha for walking us through it so beautifully. I'll say from the neurology perspective, you know, my way into giant cell arteritis and polyomyalgia rheumatica is through a totally different route and a different lens. So it was so amazing to hear it from a completely different angle that absolutely captured the way that we think about it, but really blew the whole thing open. You know, the absence of cranial symptoms, the involvement of large vessels throughout the body, and how you can really temper and nuance that reasoning perspective. So that was so great for me. I just wanted to pull out like how this case really highlighted how, you know, through Dr. Dua, through your reasoning, how sometimes the right diagnosis is really knowing that you don't yet have a diagnosis and being able to really stick to your guns and say, you know, this doesn't fit yet. It really highlighted the strategic use of time and the tincture of time and seeing how things evolve over time to really inform how we think about cases and move the needle forward. So I just wanted to pull that out, just kind of thinking through how your reasoning and your discussion played out. I just think that was so valuable for me personally, and I think for many of our listeners. So just wanted to extend that thanks.
Thank you so much. No, I really appreciate it. And I think, you know, Michael made a good point. It isn't always classic. And so, you know, this person did end up having, you know, polyomyalgia rheumatica and then responded to the 15 of prednisone, which is great. But I do think that, you know, there are those subsets of population. I would say my practice is probably closer to like less than 10%, but that don't have that response. But you don't want to anchor in one sort of clinical story, right? You can put a really clear picture of what lupus is or what GCA is. And people are nuanced and everyone has, you know, a different way of looking at it. So I think that's what is so nice about a lot of the rheumatologic diseases. Like you were saying, you have a very different perspective and I'd love to hear you go through that case, you know? So it's really nice to get different folks' ways or different specialists, subspecialists' ways of looking at the same sort of clinical presentation and how they sort of build out their differential and workup, because it's, you know, fascinating and everyone sort of has their own approach. So no, I appreciate it. It was fun to go through and yeah.
Well, we're a little bit over the hour, but I just wanted to thank Dr. Dua and Dr. Tamasha again for coming on the consult question with the CP solvers. We had such a great time with you. I feel like the listeners are going to learn so much from this case. And I know that personally, I'll be going back to it over and over again as a ID fellow to get your guys' perspective on the fever of unknown origin workup. So anyway, thank you so much. This was fantastic. Really excited.
Awesome.
We'll see you.
Of course.
Thank you.
That's a wrap, folks.